And seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice David Prosser. And on the far left is Justice Patience Rogensack. With the introductions made, I will call our second case for today, which is 02-0456, Althea, is it Pike?
Coit.
Coit, versus Wisconsin Department of Health and Family Services. Representing Ms. Coit is Carol Jean Wessels of Legal Action of Wisconsin. Counsel?
May it please the Court. My name is Carol Wessels, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Althea Coit. Althea Coit is 90 years old now, and she's out of the Mequon Care Center. She lives with her twin sister, Alva, in the family farmhouse where they were born. Because the Coits were farmers, their taxes didn't pay into the Social Security system. So Althea Coit does not have Social Security retirement benefits or Medicare benefits. 4 years ago, there was an unfortunate turn of events, and Althea Coit was in a car accident. She was hospitalized, and following the hospitalization, she was admitted to the Mequon Care Center for rehabilitation therapy. She was admitted to the Mequon Care Center just before the end of September. Again, because she did not have Medicare, Ms. Coit paid the bill for the hospitalization out of her pocket. At the time of her transfer to Mequon Care Center, she also had to pay out of pocket in advance for her admission. She paid for the few remaining days that were left in the month of September, and also she was required to pay in full for the month of October. This was because her eligibility for Medicaid had not been determined, and again, she did not have Medicare, which traditionally may have paid for that type of a service. Ms. Coit paid Mequon Care Center's private pay rate of $4,540 for the month of October. There was nothing illegal about this when it happened in September. By October, Ms. Coit's power of attorney agent had completed the Medicaid application process and had completed paying the bills for the hospitalization. And Ms. Coit was found eligible towards the end of October for medical assistance. That eligibility went back to the first of the month. The state then paid Mequon Care Center the state's regular Medicaid payment rate for that nursing home care. That was $3,471 and some change. This is where the legal problem began. Mequon Care Center accepted the state's payment for medical assistance services on behalf of Ms. Coit. However, Mequon Care Center refunded to Ms. Coit only the amount of money that the state had paid. Mequon Care Center essentially was allowed to keep the difference of a little of over $1,000, that difference being the difference between the private pay rate Ms. Coit had originally paid and the Medicaid rate that the state paid to the Mequon Care Center once Ms. Coit was determined eligible for Medicaid.
Ms. Wessels, let me, if I might, interrupt you at this point. It's my understanding that you don't, I'm misstating that, you do take issue with the Wisconsin statutes and the Wisconsin Administrative Code. You feel that those statutory sections and administrative code sections are contrary to federal law. Is that correct?
That's correct, Justice Crooks.
But you're not saying that those particular sections of the Wisconsin statutes and the Wisconsin code were misread or misapplied. You're saying they're contrary to federal law.
That's correct, Justice.
Can you tell us why?
They're contrary to federal law for three reasons. There are three different provisions of federal law that apply in this case, and all three provisions are violated by the state's policy. Essentially, the state statute and the administrative code require a provider to refund amounts that have been prepaid for medical assistance when an individual is determined to be eligible. But the state policy allows the provider to keep the difference between Medicaid's payment rate and any amount over and above that was originally paid. The reason that that particular provision that we contest. We don't contest the mandatory refund requirement. We contest the amount that the statute allows the provider to keep afterwards. And that particular section of the statute and the policy violate the federal regulation that requires states to require Medicaid providers to accept Medicaid payment as payment in full. In this case, where the provider is allowed to keep an amount over and above the Medicaid payment, the provider is not being required to accept Medicaid payment as payment in full for that service.
I just want to ask, so the point is that Wisconsin, as you're advocating, is out of line with the federal requirements. Now, I noticed that the nursing home isn't part of this action, are they?
They are not, Your Honor.
So my question would be, even if we would say that Wisconsin violated the federal MA provision, assuming, and I don't know what the answer to that is going to be, but didn't the department, in other words, when they had this question come to them, they acted under color of law because that was the law that they followed. The Wisconsin statute was there. It seems to be fairly clear. So would we be talking about reimbursement?
We would.
To your client, because you started out saying that she, is no longer there. And I got the impression that she, was not covered. And how does the money get back to her then? Do you have the authority to order that?
Yes, you do, Justice. The money would get back to her by sort of a circuitous route, because the relief that we are requesting is that the state be enjoined from enforcing that portion of the administrative code and the statute that is in violation of federal law. If the state's prevented from allowing providers to keep the change, then the state has to require them to give it back. And by requiring...
Well, they're not even a party of the action. That's what I guess I'm saying, that I couldn't see any authority that would allow this court to order the nursing home. They're a non-party to both the 1983 action and the administrative action to refund a private pay.
Justice Wilcox, we're not asking this court to order Mequon Care Center to do anything. We're asking this court to order the department to change its policy. If that order were made and the department changed its policy, because Mequon Care Center is a Medicaid provider and has to follow the state's policy, Mequon Care Center and the other nursing homes in that situation would then be required to refund the money that's over and above the Medicaid rate.
If not, you'll sue them in small claims.
Then we would theoretically have a cause of action to sue them in small claims court.
Counsel, I'm intrigued about when statutes are enacted. One of my colleagues' last oral argument raised a question at the end of oral argument, but when did that become effective, or when did the statutory change take place? I look at that same question with regard to the federal regulation for full payment. That was amended in 2002. Does the amendment at all involve the issue that is before us, the language that came in effect in 2002? What I envision is this potential scenario, that prior to the enactment of this change, that maybe Wisconsin was in compliance, but with the change, Wisconsin is no longer in compliance, that argument. Are you able to address when 42 CR 442.5, I know it was revised October 1, 2002. Did the revision affect the case here today?
Justice, I'm not able to directly address that. I do know what the regulation said in 2000, and at that point I believed that the actions were prohibited. I do know what the regulation says now, and I believe that the actions are still prohibited. However, I can't specifically address any amendment that took place in 2002 because, frankly, I'm not aware of it.
Is the language in 2000 the same as today with regard to a state plan must provide that the Medicaid agency must limit participation in the Medicaid program as providers who accept as payment in full. Is that language the language that you're relying on prior to 2002?
That is the language that we're relying on, and I do believe that language was the same through all relevant time frames in this case.
Thank you.
There are, I'd like to talk about three different things in this argument. First, I'd like to give some background on how the problem arises that we've presented to the court. Second, I'd like to talk about the federal Medicaid laws involved and how the state's policy violates those laws. And third, I'd like to talk about why an administrative hearing was required in this matter under the state's Administrative Procedure Act. The case before this court involves the amount that an elderly woman believes she is entitled to get back from the nursing home. But the issue that I'm asking this court to address can arise in a variety of circumstances. Essentially, this issue comes up any time an individual is required to pay upfront for medical care or services because they don't physically have a Medicaid card in their hand. And this can happen because an individual has applied for Medicaid, but that application has not been processed. Statutorily, the state is allowed a certain period of time in which to process an application. Individuals often need Medicare while those applications are pending. And so an individual could be required by the provider to pay up front for that service. It could also happen in a situation where an individual has applied for Title 19 and that application has been denied and is in the process of being appealed. As the amicus brief indicated, those appeals can take a considerable amount of time. All the while, an individual needing Medicare has to find a way to pay for it. So they're paying for it out of very limited funds, out of pocket. And customarily, the providers are requiring payment at the private pay rate because the individuals are not yet eligible for Medicaid. So this issue can come up in a variety of circumstances. And in all those circumstances, an individual who's waiting for an application to be processed and, for example, is paying for some prescription drugs out of pocket, or an individual whose application has been denied and is waiting for the appeal to move forward. In all of those cases, once the dust settles and either the person is determined eligible by virtue of the regular application process or an unfavorable decision is overturned at a higher level, in all of those situations, the individual has been paying out of pocket while this process has been going on, and then when the individual is finally found eligible for Medicaid, the Medicaid goes back retroactive to the time that that individual applied and also 3 months prior, if that's appropriate. In all of those cases, the state's policy does not require the providers to refund everything that that individual had to pay during that entire period. The state's policy only requires the providers to refund what Medicaid paid. In this case involving the nursing home care, the difference was over $1,000. It was The state's Medicaid rate is about 75% of the private pay rate, so it's 25% less.
If I can interrupt again, what's the problem, in your opinion, with the argument that this is really a contract matter, that when your client came to the nursing home, she contracted with the nursing home to pay for the month of October at a particular rate? That's what they charged her. That's what she paid. She was a private patient at the time. Why shouldn't they be able to keep the difference? She came to them, contracted with them to pay the $4,500 and some odd. Why shouldn't that be what they're able to charge her? They gave her what they got from MA. What's wrong with that? Isn't this a contract situation?
No, I do not believe it is. First of all, we don't have a contract in the record at all, so we can't tell what any private contract might have said that was between Mrs. Coip or Ms. Coip and the nursing facility. We don't know whether that contract provided that she was entitled to get all the money back.
Is there any dispute that she agreed to pay the $4,500 or the $139 a day for the month of October?
She paid that. Whether or not she was agreeable to it, I don't know. But in order to get admitted to the nursing home, she had to pay that. That's what she was required to pay because she was not yet certified as being eligible for Title 19.
Let me, just following up. So when she was admitted, and I want to get this in my mind factually, she, as I understand it from the briefs, she was neither a medical assistant recipient, we know that, or she was not an applicant at the time she made the agreement to come into the home. In other words, she was neither.
At that time,
is that a correct statement?
At the end of September, she had not applied for medical assistance. So at that time, she was not a medical assistance recipient.
So I guess the point I was listening to Justice Crooks is that at the time, it was like anybody, if we go there and, you know, we want to enter this institution and their rates are $4,500 a month and there's an agreement we're going to pay that. Now, what happened here happened later. In other words, as I understand it, she became not only an applicant, but then a recipient. But at the time she entered the institution, she didn't have any of these, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And the reason that we're not alleging that any law was violated in September when the money was collected, we're alleging that the law was violated when the payment was accepted. Because once the payment was accepted on behalf of Althea Coip as a Medicaid-eligible individual, then the provider became bound by the requirement of payment in full, of accepting that payment as payment in full. And so any amounts that had been collected prior to that had to be refunded.
Her status changed. That's what I'm – in other words, there's a private pay and then there's the medical assistance. And there's – you're not arguing that there's anything wrong with having private pay more or less than a medical assistant person, in other words, getting aid. So the idea that I'm trying to process here is that at the time it would be like a person coming in. Well, many things change, but she wasn't even an applicant at the time she entered. So what you're saying is that if your status changes while you're there, then you're entitled to pay the lower rate.
That's correct. And it's contemplated that your status can change on a retroactive basis. That's the whole point of the retroactivity provision, that what may happen at the outset can be changed, and it can be changed retroactively. And that takes into consideration, when Congress enacted that provision, takes into consideration the fact that people like Althea Coip may suffer a sudden illness or, like in this case, a car accident.
Counselor, if I could just interrupt you in a minute. Could the nursing home have rejected her application? In other words, when she decided she wanted to come into the nursing home, could they have said, no, we're not going to take you?
Yes, they could have said no.
And what kind of notice, if any, did the nursing home have on the day they accepted her that she might later have a change in status such that they would be required under your theory to give her a refund?
I can't speak specifically to what the nursing home in this particular case would have had. Customarily, when a person is admitted to a nursing home, the nursing home assumes that at some point the individual is going to be reliant on Medicaid or Medicare because of the high cost of nursing home care. And the question is just when that eligibility is becoming effective. However,
but nursing homes have people that are there full-time on private pay. Not everyone that's in a nursing home collects from the state to be there, correct?
That's correct. And
if you have funds of your own, in fact, you're required to pay them rather than to seek eligibility, right?
That's correct.
My concern is, you know, we have your client as a party, and we have the state's agency as a party, but we've got a lot of folks out there whose interests are going to be affected by our decision if we take your tact, and they're not here to speak for what effect this may have on them and what position they were in when they took your client, and were they to know that she wasn't someone that would continually pay privately, and did they rely on that when they took her payment? So, you know, I have some concerns about how we fit all three interests together when we don't have one of them before us.
Just as the Mequon Care Center participated in the fair hearing process in this case, they were notified of the fair hearing process and they submitted information, which is in the record at 23 of the appellate record, and the information specifically from Mequon Care Center is at page 7.
Yeah, Counselor, my concern is
is more generic than the particular care center, because our decision will affect a whole lot more than Mequon Care Center. And my concern is how do we affect the rights of a group of people that aren't joined in this appellate process that we're involved in? And I understand your position is we're not being asked to direct Mequon Care Center to do anything. We're being asked to direct the state to do something. But if we do what you say, we do affect the interests of every nursing home that has provided care to someone who was neither an applicant nor a recipient at the time they chose to accept that person. And I guess it's you know, it's kind of a fairness thing that's bothering me just a little bit. I don't know what they would say. I mean, maybe they'd agree with everything you say, or maybe they'd agree with everything the state says, or maybe they would have a totally different take on it that just hasn't occurred to you or the state or to me, frankly.
For them, Justice, it would be a business decision, ultimately. Providers are not required to accept Medicaid payment, so if they feel that the court's decision is inherently unfair to them or significantly affects their business decisions, they have the right not to take Medicaid patients at all.
But they wouldn't know. When they took someone like your client, they wouldn't know what they were taking, and that's what's bothering them.
Justice, what nursing homes customarily do when a patient is admitted is they go through a lengthy financial documentation that discloses the patient's assets, liabilities, sources of insurance, and such. And so they may have considerable amount of information. They don't have a crystal ball as to what's going to happen to those assets, but they certainly can get a picture up front of the types of assets that that the individual does have, and they can from then predict essentially how long the person might remain on private pay status. What they can't do is require the patient to waive their right to Medicaid when the patient is eligible, and that's in a sense what would happen here if the private contract took precedence over the Medicaid payment in full and retroactivity provisions. Then we would be enforcing a private contract that required, in essence, a waiver of the Medicaid benefit.
Was the contract unlawful when it was signed?
If the contract would be interpreted as waiving Ms. Coit's right to the Medicaid benefit, then the contract was unlawful. I don't have a copy of the contract in the record, so I can't determine, you know, for this court whether specifically that was the case. I doubt it, because there has been a lot of information from the Attorney General and so forth specifying that nursing facilities can't require a waiver, and that's also in a federal regulation. But if it's interpreted as requiring a waiver, which it in essence the state is allowing to happen, then it's in violation of those protections as well. It would be an illegal contract, mm-hmm. and that's the position we took in our brief.
Ms. Wessels, is there anything in the record that would show that, for instance, a private pay patient is housed differently than a Medicaid patient? What I'm thinking about is my own knowledge is that oftentimes if you're private pay, you may have a private room. If you're a Medicaid or Medicare patient, you may share a room with someone else. Does the record reflect anything in that regard in regard to this Mequon Care Center?
The record does not, Justice Crooks.
Is there anything in the record that would indicate your client was moved to a different room once she became a Medicaid patient?
There's nothing that would indicate that, Justice.
Would that go to your right of action against the center rather than your cause of action here, these questions?
If those questions were, if she was discriminated against in any way because of her status as a Medicaid recipient, that would be an additional cause.
Well, I don't think that's the point of the question. It's not that she was discriminated against, but if she's a private pay, she gets A, B, C, D, E, which is more costly than the services provided to a someone on MA. And it could be that in the private patients, you might have choices of what services you want, plan 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and those plans differ as to costs. Therefore, this $1,000, if I may follow through as to what I think Justice Crooks was driving at, might be due to the fact that they put her on plan 5, which is the most costly, instead of the MA plan, which is the least costly, so that they really don't, the center doesn't owe her that $1,000 because she has gotten services for that $1,000. I mean, that was, I think, the point of the question.
Justice, there are provisions in Medicaid law that allow essentially surcharges for services that aren't covered by Medicaid, but those have to be specifically set forth and agreed to separately, and that's not what Mequon Care Center indicated in its response, and that's not in the record. I don't believe that was the case.
This is a straight legal issue. Assuming all the services are the same, do you have to refund the excess $1,000? Now, but you agreed, I think, initially that that isn't the issue in this case because the center isn't here. What is here is the department. So it seems to me you are asserting that the statute and the department regulations, as they have interpreted it, are invalid. They're unconstitutional under the Supremacy Clause of the Federal Constitution. Isn't that your basic argument?
We haven't raised a constitutionality argument, Justice, but they're contrary to the federal regulations that we cited in the brief. Absolutely.
I know you haven't raised a constitutional argument, but aren't you, in effect, raising a constitutional argument?
As a state that accepts Medicaid payment, the state is required to follow the federal Medicaid laws.
Right.
So those take precedence.
But you're asking this court to tell the department that the statute has to be read in a different way to fit the feds. And the regulations have to be read in a different way.
That's correct. Unless there are any further questions, that
Justice
concludes.
Justice Bradley has one.
Yes, Justice.
Counsel, you said that the providers are not required to accept Medicaid patients or Medicaid payments. Why can't the argument be made that, okay, for this month in question, we are not going to accept Medicaid payments?
Because the record says that they did accept the Medicaid payment. They took that $3,400 from the state. They could have refused it, I think. That issue is not before the court. There may be other litigation issues involved in that question. But that's not what happened. They accepted the payment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Bruce A. Olson, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Wisconsin Department of Health and Family Services et al. Mr. Olson.
May it please the Court. Excuse me. My name is Bruce Olson. I represent the Department of Health and Family Services and its Secretary, Helene Nelson. I'd like to apologize from the outset at the quality of my voice. I hope that it doesn't deteriorate further, but I'll apologize just once, and then I'll cough probably many times, for which I beg your forgiveness. I learned a lot about the facts in this case just this morning from Ms. Wessel, or at least what might be the facts in this case. She gave us a long history of Ms. Koip's personal history, none of which is in the record. I think this court is faced with a much narrower issue because those facts are not in the record because the contract between Mequon Care Center and Ms. Koip is not in the record. I think what this court is faced with is essentially a facial challenge to the state's medical assistance partial reimbursement statute and the administrative rules. Now, Ms. Wessels suggested to the court that the statute applied in circumstances that I really disagree with. She suggests that it applies in situations when a person has applied for medical assistance on a particular day, they've been denied, and now they are on appeal. She says that the statute would allow a nursing home or any other provider to retain payments, private pay payments that it received after the date of eligibility, or after the date of application, but before eligibility was finally determined. I think the face of the statute, the face of the administrative rules, clearly indicate just the contrary. The only time that a nursing home or other provider is permitted to retain a portion of the private pay rate that it received is during a period of services received, well, during a retroactive period, not during a period after the date of application. I think we should just make sure that we understand that What is at issue in this case are payments made by Ms. Coit while she was a private pay patient, before she had applied for medical assistance, and, of course, long before she was determined to be eligible for MA.
Why doesn't the nursing home just not accept the medical payment reimbursement? Then we wouldn't have a problem.
Why does the nursing
home? For this retroactively.
Just do it prospectively.
Well,
yeah.
Easy
to me.
Well, the nursing home is, the statute says that when a person has applied for medical assistance and is determined to be eligible, they can ask the nursing home to apply for MA benefits, and the state has to then provide them to the nursing home, which in turn, by statute, has to be returned to the recipient, or to the private pay patient.
Well, maybe I'm wrong, but I mean, the federal regulations that you run into trouble with is the full pay provision and then the 3-month retroactive provision. And your opposing counsel is saying, look, you've agreed that Medicaid payments is full pay, payment in full under 42 CFR 447, and then it applies for 3 months that should constitute payment in full. You know, it's retroactive. So, boy, it seems to me if they would have just said, boy, this month I'm not going to do it. We're not going to accept medical assistance, but we can prospectively, you wouldn't have this problem.
I don't think they're permitted under federal law to make that choice.
What law is it that precludes them from doing that?
It would be the payment in full regulation, at least as the parties have been arguing this case, 42 CFR 447.15.
Well, then what does that mean? That the providers who accept Medicaid have to accept the payment as payment in full. Okay, you're saying they have to do that. So why don't they do that and give $1,000 back then? I don't understand how you rely on that when your opposing counsel is relying.
I think we have to return to the definition of medical assistance. Medical assistance is defined as payment of part or all of the cost of care and services provided to an individual during a period of retroactive eligibility. And so then medical assistance permits payment of part of the cost of care provided to an individual during a period of retroactivity. I think the payment in full statute applies to medical assistance recipients, but at the time Ms. Coit paid, she was not a medical assistance recipient. If you were to apply this statute as meaning that nursing homes could not or had to accept payment in full for every individual, whether they were a medical assistance recipient or a private pay patient, I think you'd have absolutely ludicrous results on the regulation, because the regulation says that the Medicaid agency must limit participation in the Medicaid program to providers who accept as payment in full, first, the amounts paid by the agency. Well, for private pay patients, that's zero, plus any deductible, coinsurance, or copayment required by the plan, meaning the state plan, to be paid to individuals. Well, since the state plan doesn't cover non-Medicaid recipients, that amount is also zero. So if you were to apply this regulation to private pay patients, you would say that nursing homes are required to accept medical assistance as payment in full for MA recipients, but for private patients, they have to let them in free. That can't be.
What does 3M mean? This is under 49, 3M.
Mm-hmm.
2. Upon receipt of payment, and that must be from MA, I think.
I think that has to be from MA, yes.
The provider, that's the center here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shall reimburse the applicant or other person who has made prior payment to the provider. Is that Ms. Coit? Shall reimburse the applicant?
Yes.
Okay.
And then it has to be read in conjunction with the last sentence.
Now, well, that's what I'm getting to. Explain the last sentence to me. No provider, that's the center, may be required to reimburse the applicant, that's Ms. Coyne, or other person, in excess of the amount reimbursed under Section 4945. What's the amount reimbursed under 4945?
That's the medical assistance rate.
So what does that mean?
It means that no provider can be required to reimburse Ms. Coyne payments that she made in excess of the medical assistance rate. They are required to return to her the medical assistance component of her private pay payment in September, but
and
not
that's the state statute. So under the state statute, they only had to give them $3,000 plus.
That's correct.
So what about the federal law? What federal law authorizes that provision?
The federal law that authorizes that are, in part, it is the definition of medical assistance, which defines medical assistance as payment of all or part of the cost of care and services provided to an individual during a retroactive period. So medical assistance authorizes payment of part of the cost. That's one. The regulations go on to provide that Medicaid just doesn't govern the economic relationship between nursing homes and private pay patients. The statutes, 42 U.S.C. 1396 R, C, 4, capital A, you got to love medical assistance law, says that although nursing homes have to, quote, establish and maintain identical policies and practices regarding transfer, discharge, and the provision of services required under the state plan for all individuals, regardless of the source of payment, that requirement shall not, and I quote again, shall not be construed as prohibiting a nursing home from charging, this would be non-medical assistance patients, any amount for services furnished. That's reinforced by the regulations even more explicitly. And those are 42 CFR, and the section is 483.12C2. The facility may charge any amount for services furnished to non-Medicaid residents consistent with the notice requirement of 483 and such.
She is a MA patient, so I don't find those persuasive. They can charge me going in privately $10,000. They can only charge her $3,600. That's what Ms. Coyne is arguing.
That's what she's arguing, yes.
But the stuff you read me, the regulations you read me, cover people who are not on MA, and she is on MA.
She is currently on MA. She was not at the time the payment was made on MA, and I think
if she had prepaid 3 months, just for the heck of it,
mm-hmm.
and got on MA as of October 1, but she got on MA before November 1, you're saying they would refund her the $1,000 for November and December?
No. What happened, that's
why not?
A variation on one of the scenarios that Ms. Wessel spelled out. The partial reimbursement statute and administrative rules say that for services rendered during a period of retroactive eligibility, that the nursing home has to refund the medical assistance portion, but can keep the difference between that and the private pay portion. Now, under the scenario that you have suggested, she applies in she pays in September for the months of October, November, and December. She's declared eligible. She applies in October and is declared eligible in October. as of November 1st, she's not in a period of retroactive eligibility. She's in a period of prospective eligibility. Right. And in that case, the statute doesn't apply.
What statute?
49-3M and the two administrative rules, the partial reimbursement statute and rules that we've been talking about. Because they apply only in situations where payment is made for services rendered during a period of retroactive eligibility. For periods of prospective eligibility, I think the payment in full regulation applies, and the nursing home would be required to reimburse Ms. Coip the full amount that she hypothetically paid during the month, or for care rendered in the months of November and December.
Counselor, if I could ask you a quick question, just changing the Chief Justice's question a little bit. Say she applied in September, but there was a delay in deciding that she was eligible. So she paid for September, October, and November, and then at the end of November, she finds out she's eligible, and they put it back to the 1st of September. Okay. Under your reading of the statute, would the nursing home be required to repay money to her under any of those months?
No. I'm sorry. It would be required to repay her the private pay rate for all of those months, because the services would not have been rendered for a period of retroactive eligibility.
Well, but maybe I didn't say it correctly. What I'm asking you for is an extension of what occurred here. She had 1 month's lapse, but you can date Medicare back 3 months. So let's just
say
she was in the nursing home those 3 months. And when the decision came down, now she's eligible back to the beginning. So the state's going to pay for 3 months. And are you saying that for each of those 3 months, the nursing home gets to keep the extra on the payment that was made?
Let me see if I understand the hypothetical correctly. Sure. She applies in September. And in that month, she pays for September and prospectively.
Right.
And in October, she is declared eligible.
No, she's declared eligible at the end of November, and they date it back to the beginning of September. So she's got September, October, November that she's paid in advance for. She paid at a private rate for. Now Medicare is going to pay the nursing home those 3 months because she's eligible. The nursing home is going to give her what Medicaid gave her. And my question is the nursing home for each of those 3 months get to keep the money in addition to the Medicaid rate?
Services rendered during months after the month or in or after the month of application.
Yes.
The party are services, I think, rendered during prospective periods of eligibility, not retrospective periods of eligibility, because retrospective periods of eligibility are tied to the date of the application in September.
Well, didn't she apply in October, and wasn't it an October payment we're talking about here?
That's correct.
Okay, well, I guess let's just put it October through December then, and then we won't get goofed up. If she applied in October, and say she paid 3 months in advance, she's paid October, November, and December. At the end of December, the state decides she's eligible, and they date it back to the 1st of October, just like it was dated here, but it was done later because the process took longer. And my question to you was, does the nursing home get to keep the extra money for October, November, and December? And you said no, but I don't see how it's any different. I mean, she applied in October. She was an applicant mid-October. She was an applicant in November. She was an applicant in December. So how is that scenario different than what we have, except we have 3 months instead of 1 month?
She was an applicant at all of those months, but the important time that distinguishes between retrospective and prospective is the date of application. For the month of October, she would have been in a period of retrospective eligibility. And under the statute, the nursing home gets to retain the private pay portion of her payment. For the months of November and December, they come after the date of application. And so then you're saying there would be periods of prospective relief, and the nursing home would have to refund the entire amount.
Okay, so you're saying if someone applies during a month, that whole month is considered to be prospective. But if the application was already pending at the beginning of the month, it's retrospective?
If a person applies during the month, that month is retrospective.
Well, then why didn't she get her money back in this month? She applied during October. Why didn't she get
paid? She paid for services. She paid in September for services rendered in October.
Right, and she applied in October.
And she applied in October.
Right, and isn't that what we're arguing about? She wants her money back for October.
She does want her money back from October.
Right.
October is not a month of full prospective eligibility for her.
I understand that completely, but she was given nothing back, not just the money that would have been taken before she applied, but she was given nothing for the whole month. It's $1,000, isn't that what we're talking about?
She paid $4,500 in September.
Right.
In October, after she was declared eligible,
right,
the nursing home reimbursed her $3,500.
Right.
The nursing home did not reimburse her nothing.
No,
the nursing home reimbursed
her
$3,500 and retained the extra $1,000.
Okay, but does the $1,000 cover the full 30 days, or is the $1,000 just from the date of application to the end of November?
The $1,000 covers the full 30 days.
Okay. Well, we're not communicating this morning somehow. Why does the $1,000 cover the full 30 days if after the application is in process, the services rendered are then retrospective rather than prospective? Why doesn't she get half the month back, if that's the marker?
I think this is something that is, this is really troubling to me, and it should be really troubling to the court. Because if this court decides that some portion of the month of October is not a period of retrospective relief or retrospective eligibility, if the month of October is all prospective eligibility, with me so far, then the statute, the partial reimbursement statute, just doesn't apply to this case because it applies only for periods of retrospective eligibility. If October is a month of prospective eligibility, then the problem is that MEC 1 Care Center misapplied the statute.
Okay, I guess what I'm trying to get clear in my own mind, I hope you'll be patient with me, is I'm not understanding how you're applying the statute. Is there something in the statute that makes us take a whole month because you start out the month as not being an applicant? Is there something in there that is applied to the whole month and then the month after it? In my example, it's all, you know, retrospective because the application was pending for the full month. Is there something in there that talks about using the whole month?
It's just the way that the medical assistance program is run. It's run on the basis of month per month. So you apply anytime during a month, and if you are eligible on that date, eligibility is determined as of the first of the month. If that eligibility is considered prospective eligibility, that month of application, if that is considered prospective eligibility, then the partial reimbursement statute doesn't apply because that applies only to periods of retrospective eligibility. And if the statute doesn't apply, then Ms. Coip has no standing to challenge the statute because she isn't injured by it. And this court has to dismiss this case for lack of standing.
Yeah, we're still not on the same page, but I'll think about it a little bit more. Thank you.
What is the line of demarcation for prospective eligibility and retroactive eligibility? Maybe this will help.
I'm not going to give you a very satisfactory answer because this case was litigated on the basis of an assumption by the parties, by Ms. Coip and the department, that the payment that she made to cover the cost of her care in October was payment for a period of retrospective eligibility.
I'm not talking about on the facts of this case. I'm talking about legally. In the law, what is the date of, what is the when does prospective eligibility begin and when does retroactive eligibility begin? The date of application, I think, is what you've been arguing.
What I've been arguing has been based on the assumption of the parties during the course of this litigation. As a legal matter, the department doesn't take a position on that. The department hasn't litigated that issue, didn't litigate it in this case, hasn't litigated it in prior cases. And I don't think that now, in an argument before this court, is a time for me to offer some off-the-cuff interpretation as to when prospective eligibility begins and when retrospective eligibility ends.
Isn't that critical to our interpretation of the statutory scheme?
I would think that it might be.
Did you respond?
Nobody's taking a position on it then.
I mean, that's one of the problems when Ms. Kuip has a gripe against the nursing home, and rather than sue the nursing home, she asks for a fair hearing before the department. And when the department denies it for lack of jurisdiction, she files a petition for review and a 1983 official capacity claim, arguing that the policy is one that injured her. I mean, that's part of the problem is that, you know, just the wrong parties here. The real parties should be Ms. Kuip against Mequon Care Center. She sues them.
What would Mequon Care Center say?
Mequon Care Center, I assume, well, I don't know what they would say. I know what they did say in this case up to a certain point, and they said that the payment for the month of October was payment for fit the statute. It was going to rely on the statute in withholding the reimbursement of the about $1,000. I assume that it would make that argument again. Ms. Kuip would assert that violates federal law, and the case would come up in a real case in controversy before
Wouldn't
this court.
Would you intervene to protect your statute and regulations?
The department probably would have standing to intervene, yes.
Okay. Well, we're here. And all your responses to Justice Rogensack said the line of demarcation was the application. I mean, that was your response to her and to me.
And that's the way that the case was litigated by the parties. That's true.
But the department doesn't stand on that principle. Is that it?
The department just used that assumption as the way the case proceeded.
Well, why didn't you assume that it was when she entered the nursing home and she intended to apply, and so it's all prospective? I mean, that's as good an assumption as the one you're giving us.
That could have been the assumption on which the case was litigated, but that wasn't the assumption. I mean, the argument that the month of application is really a period of prospective eligibility was first raised by the amicus in this case. If the month of application is a period of prospective eligibility, then the partial reimbursement statute and the rules don't apply to this case.
Well, why didn't you take that position? What was your position?
My
position is that they don't get the money. Your position is there's no jurisdiction.
My position is that there's no jurisdiction.
But if there's jurisdiction, what's your position?
On the question of when retrospective and prospective eligibility begin, the department doesn't take a position.
Well, what's your position on pages 7, et cetera, in your brief? A private pay nursing home patient doesn't have a federal right to reimbursement from the provider for the amount originally prepaid by the patient in excess of the MA reimbursement. That's your position on the federal law. They don't have that right. Is it geared to prospective and retroactive?
I'm sorry, I must have.
I'm saying your right is under the federal law, there's no right to the October payment, the $1,000, right?
Under federal law, there's no right to the October payment. I think that federal law permits that result by state law as the parties interpreted it in this case.
All right. And when does the federal government have a line of demarcation, or don't they?
I don't think they do. The federal retroactivity provisions define the beginning of a period of retroactivity, which is the beginning of the month, 3 months prior to the month of application, but doesn't define the end point of that retroactive period. And that's what we're talking about in this case.
But do you think this case is properly before us, other than jurisdiction?
I think the case is probably, well, it depends in part on the, if you accept the party's assumption that this case was litigated on, that we are talking about the October payment, and the October payment is a period of retrospective eligibility, then I think the case is properly before this court on a facial challenge to that statute.
Mr. Olson, maybe you could explain to us briefly before your time is up why the department takes the position that there was no jurisdiction here in terms of hearing her request for full reimbursement.
Certainly, Your Honor. Well, the Division of Hearings and Appeals has limited jurisdiction. It's defined under Section 4945. 5A, and it allows the Division of Hearings and Appeals to hear cases from any person whose application for medical assistance is denied, that's not Ms. Coyp, or whose application for medical assistance is not acted on promptly, that's not Ms. Coyp. She applied on October 21st and was declared eligible on October 29th, or who believes that the payments made in the person's behalf have not been properly determined. Those payments, I think, can only mean payments made, medical assistance payments made by the department. Payments made by Ms. Coyp, I think, don't really fit the statutory definition of payments made in the person's behalf. And the fourth ground for jurisdiction is that his or her eligibility has not been properly determined. And there's no argument in this case as to whether Ms. Coyp's eligibility has been properly determined. She was determined eligible as of October 1st. So I think that's why the Division of Hearings and Appeals had no jurisdiction over this case. This was really essentially a contract case where Mequon Care Center had a statutory defense. And that isn't the sort of case where the department has jurisdiction.
Assuming we agree with you on that that jurisdictional issue, we still have a 1983 claim in the suit.
That's correct.
And it's my understanding that your argument on that claim is that there is no enforceable federal right here because the full payment provision of the federal Medicaid law does not apply to this period of retroactivity. Is that a fair statement?
That's one of the reasons. On a more analytical point, I think the law is pretty clear that in order to create an enforceable right under 1983, in spending clause cases like this, the federal law has to unambiguously impose a condition on the states. And I don't think that whatever group of federal statutes and regulations you read in this case, they don't unambiguously require Mequon Care Center to reimburse Ms. Coyp for her October private pay payment.
That's what I'm driving at. And more specifically, it's not what they require Mequon Care Center to do, but what they require the state to do. And as I read the payment in full regulation in federal law, it requires the state to limit participation in Medicaid to those providers who agree to accept Medicaid as payment in full. And it's your argument that, again, that only applies, to get to the merits now, that only applies to the period of prospective eligibility, whenever that begins, and not to the period of retroactive eligibility, whenever that begins and ends.
That's correct. Yes, that's correct. The payment in full provision, I think, does not apply to payments made privately, private pay patients who make payments for periods of care that are after the date of that payment. I think that the payment in full stat regulation just does not apply to that. And part of the reason I think why that regulation does not apply is because there's another specific regulation in the medical assistance rules 42 CFR 483.12, paren C, paren 2, that says expressly that the facility may charge any amount for services furnished to non-Medicaid residents. All they need to do is give notice of those charges.
But once a person has been determined to be Medicaid eligible retroactively, doesn't that confer Medicaid eligibility status on that person?
It does, and Ms. Kuiper received the entire medical assistance benefit that she would have been entitled to had October been a month of prospective relief for her. It was $106 and change a day. That's exactly what the state paid on behalf of Ms. Kuiper for her care during the month of October. She happened to pay a little extra. Of course, we don't know what she got in exchange for that, a private room, television, radio, TV. There are all kinds of amenities that are not covered by medical assistance that you know we just don't know about in this record. That's why I think this has to be a facial challenge.
Could I ask if Ms. Kuiper had started the nursing home care on September 1 and had applied at the same time, do I understand it that the feds could have ruled it back all the way to September 1?
If she entered the nursing home on September 1 and applied for medical assistance on that day?
No, and when she applied in October?
If she had entered the nursing home on September 1 and the nursing home had not required her to pay anything in advance for her care for the month of September.
No, they did. They
okay.
Did.
So she privately paid for in the month of September when she entered the nursing
in
home.
October.
And she applied in October and was declared eligible back to
September 1.
I'm not sure that that's a hugely different case than this one. Assuming that she privately paid before the time of her application.
It seems to me there might be a temptation to finesse this case by saying we're talking about October, it was applied for in October, and so we're going to consider October prospective. But isn't the real issue that if you apply in October, you could have gone back 3 months?
If you were otherwise eligible, I mean, there is that provision in the law that requires you to be otherwise eligible. Ms. Kuiper in September may not have met the financial criteria or may not have had a disability.
Potentially. You could go back 3 months.
Potentially.
All right.
That was my question.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Ms. Wessel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I believe that the quagmire that was raised by Justice Rogenczak's original question in terms of when was this prospective or retrospective eligibility is answered very simply. The question of whether the eligibility in this case was retroactive or prospective is simply one element of this case. If you analyze the state statute in terms of the payment in full regulation, the federal payment in full regulation turns not on prospective or retrospective eligibility. It doesn't matter when that decision was made. What matters is that the provider accepted payment on behalf of an individual. Whether that payment was for a month in the future or a month in the past or the month in which it was accepted, that payment has to be accepted as payment in full. So that alleviates, even just on that regulation alone, you eliminate the need to struggle with the question of retroactive eligibility in this matter. Retroactive eligibility is another problem with the state statute, but independently you have the payment in full problem. And when Mequon Care Center accepted payment for the month of October and did not keep that payment as payment in full because they didn't refund the money that she had already paid for October, then you had a violation of the payment in full regulation.
The provider doesn't have the choice legally.
Well,
reject or accept the Medicaid payment.
They have the choice. If they're a Medicaid participating provider, they have to accept the Medicaid payment. They can't pick and choose for an eligible individual that I'll take Medicaid for October and I'm not going to take it for December. And they can't make those kinds of choices, but they can choose whether or not to take Medicaid patients. So they could have said to Ms. Coit, we don't take Medicaid patients. If you become eligible for Medicaid, you have to find another place to get your rehabilitation therapy. They could have said that. They didn't. They took the payment.
Once they accepted her as a private pay customer, they did not have the legal option to reject her Medicaid claim, the retroactive portion of it or the prospective portion of it. And I read the retroactivity regulations. If she's got that status, they have to accept or file that claim and then funnel through the reimbursement to her.
If they accept the Medicaid payment on her behalf, yes.
They don't have the choice to reject it. They've accepted her as a private paying customer. She subsequently applies for Medicaid benefits. She is declared eligible prospectively as well as retroactively for whatever period of retroactivity there is, since that appears to be in dispute when that starts and begins. But in any event, under those circumstances, the law requires the provider to submit the claim on the claimant's behalf and to refund or reimburse the payment once it's received.
That's correct.
Okay. So this argument about Mequon Care Center having accepted the payment, it didn't have any choice legally.
That's correct. It's a Medicaid provider, and she was a Medicaid-eligible individual at the time, so it had to take the payment and it had to make the refund.
Counselor, could you respond briefly to your opponent's argument that there simply isn't jurisdiction in this case?
I believe there is jurisdiction in that we've established both a claim under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. I think each of the three federal regulations that are involved are specific, are intended to benefit the plaintiffs, and are mandatory upon the states. That's the three-part Blessing versus Freestone test, and I believe it's been met in this case. In terms of the fair hearing requirement, the analogy, I guess the state's taking a position that it would rather have Medicaid beneficiaries suing providers in court on an individual basis to get back payments of $1,000 or $50 or whatever it is, based on this, that they've refused to refund based on a state statute that completely legitimizes that refusal. So instead of challenging the statute through the fair hearing process, the state would have us individually sue those providers. The fair hearing process has to do, the State Administrative Procedure Act allows an individual who's been aggrieved by an action or an inaction of the agency to request and receive a fair hearing. We believe and take the position that the inaction here, it's an action and an inaction. It's an action in creating an illegal policy. It's an inaction in failing to require the providers to provide a full refund. The way to address that is to request a fair hearing and ask for the state to enforce that law. The fair hearing process, in essence, is not only is it provided for in the Administrative Procedure Act, but it also makes the most sense. I mean, if we've got claims for Medicaid beneficiaries who are low income, they're probably not going to get a lawyer to represent them on a $50 claim. Legal action represented Ms. Coit on a $1,000 claim because the issue was greater than the $1,000. But they're not going to be able to get individual lawyers to run into court and sue these providers for $1,000 or $50. What makes sense is to have a fair hearing so that the provider can be required to make the reimbursement. So that in this case, it's a fair hearing so that this policy that allows the providers not to make the reimbursement can be changed. If that were to be changed, I think we probably wouldn't have to run into court and sue the providers. They're interested in continued receipt of their Medicaid payments from the state. Most of them participate in the Medicaid program, and they're going to accept the state's rules. This is not a rogue provider who's not following the rules.
What statute or administrative rule gives DHSF any authority over a private nursing home to do anything?
It gives them authority because they're a Medicaid provider.
What statute, though? What, can you refer me to a statute that I can read to see if I agree with your interpretation or not?
The federal law at there's a lengthy set of statutes that are mandatory on Medicaid providers, and they start in the federal law at 42 U.S.C. 1396A, and it talks about the required contents of state plans for medical assistance.
Right.
State plans, the federal law sets forth both requirements in terms of benefits that have to be provided, services that have to be provided, and individuals that have to be covered. And it also sets forth requirements that providers have to follow, like health and safety and certification. If the providers don't comply with those rules, they lose their certification for Medicaid and they can't take that payment.
Right, but how does that federal rule, if that's what you're relying on, which I'm looking at here, bring these private providers under the state auspices of DHFS to order them to refund money?
Well, the for example, 42 CFR 447.15, the payment in full regulation, is one of those federal regulations that states enforce upon providers. The states must require the providers to accept Medicaid payment as payment in full. That's a condition of their being accepted, the providers being accepted to participate in the Medicaid program, like a provider being a participant in any sort of HMO program. That insurance program has rules, and if the provider wants to take payments from that insurance company, they have to follow the rules. That's how it is with Medicaid. If the provider wants to be able to get Medicaid payments, and most providers do, because it's a huge source of income for the providers, then they have to follow the rules that the state sets up and the rules that the federal government sets up. That's a condition of their being approved providers. Those are not only rules about payment and billing, but rules about health and safety. They wouldn't be free to disregard those rules either.
Well, you know, I can understand that they have to follow those rules, but I guess I'm still concerned why don't we just have a lawsuit in court and then you're enforcing these rules against. I understand it's not convenient, but I'm looking at a statutory basis for it. And you can raise everything in a lawsuit against a nursing home that you're raising to me now, but the link that bothers me is I still don't see where DHSF has authority over the nursing home to say you must make a refund.
Well, they did. That's what the state statute says in this case. And we're not challenging their authority to tell them to make a refund. We're challenging the amount of refund that they told them to make. But the state has that authority. It did that in the statute because these are Medicaid providers. So it has authority to govern them in terms of the payments that they accept, in terms of you know, the rules that they have to follow. Mequon Care Center, I want to stress to this court, Mequon Care Center participated in the fair hearing. It submitted evidence, and it made its position clear that it was relying on the state policy. We don't have a claim against Mequon Care Center until the state policy has changed. The state, the Division of Administrative Hearings, could have brought Mequon Care Center in as a party to the administrative hearing process. It's a little bit late to claim that they didn't have notice and that they're being, Mequon Care Center is being deprived of due process, because the state could have brought them in. Ms. Coy, as an applicant or as a recipient of MA, wasn't obliged to incorporate them into the fair hearing process. But they were there anyway. They made their appearance. They could have appeared in circuit court as an interested party. They could have filed an amicus before this court, and they didn't. I don't think that there's a due process question in terms of their participation in this case. But the end result, if suing the provider is what we're supposed to do, is a lot of piecemeal litigation over little bitty amounts of money and a very difficult situation for Medicaid recipients.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wessels. Thank you, Mr. Olson, for your argument in this difficult statutory and regulatory scheme. That concludes our hearing on 02-0456, Althea Coip versus Wisconsin Department of Health and Family Services. The court will be in recess until 1:45. The students should remain. They will be joined by others. And Justice Sykes will be out in a few moments. We are in recess.